Hereby call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means General Government Subcommittee for Tuesday, February 14th. Good afternoon, members of the committee, and to those in the audience. We will open a work session with the Department of Revenue, and we'll start our various reports, first with a report on elderly rental assistance and nonprofit housing programs. Karen Gregory, Director, and Ken Ross, Legislative Coordinator, if you'll come forward, we'll begin the festivities. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the Acting Director of the Department of Revenue. And with me is Ken Ross, our Legislative Coordinator. And Ken is actually going to go over the report for you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Ken Ross, Legislative Coordinator at the Department of Revenue. I'm going to do a high-level overview of the report that we submitted for the elderly rental assistance and the nonprofit housing programs. Both these programs give rental assistance to the elderly, and they have a couple common things. They share appropriation each biennium, and they also have a property tax component. I'm going to talk about them each one separately and go through what we looked at and where we ended up. And when I say we, I mean the Department of Revenue. We met with Oregon Housing and Community Services, the Department of Human Services, people from Leading Age Oregon, which at the time was known as the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, and we also had a person from Clackamas County there on occasion. So talking a little bit about ERA, began back in the 70s to provide some rental assistance for elderly people. And in this program, elderly is defined as age 58 or older. There are certain criteria that they must meet to get this assistance, which comes in the form of an annual payment. So they get a payment one time a year. They make application in the summer, in July, and we process and send a payment in late October, early November. The criteria is they must be, of course, age 58 or older, have less than $10,000 of income, less than $25,000 in assets. They must pay more than 20% of their income for rent, and the property that they rent must be subject to property tax. Just a couple numbers on the program itself. It actually peaked as far as participants in 1990 with just over 11,300 participants. In 2011, so last November, we sent checks to just over 2,500 people. It peaked dollar-wise in 92, $6.5 million back then. Last November, we sent just under $1 million. As far as oversight, the Department of Revenue provides and processes the forms to apply for a rental assistance, and we also send the payments. And we do some work with the Department of Human Services to verify eligibility. We looked at the overlap of this program with other programs that the state may have. This is where Housing and Community Services came in. They do offer more than one rental assistance program that is somewhat similar. They, for example, a couple of them, a tenant-based rental assistance is one of them, and that is rental assistance that is not age-restricted. They also have a low-income rental housing fund, which is age-restricted. Their goal is... And most of these are designed to help folks that are at risk, and that could be in various ways. One of the at risks they look at is at risk of becoming homeless, so they target it a little bit more. They help through these programs. They pay or subsidize rents or deposits or utility payments. And they do that for the short term, and that short term could range from 6 to 24 months. So there are a couple programs at Housing that do overlap. We looked at options of what to do with this program. Of course, the first option is to eliminate the program, which would save about $2 million in a biennium. We also looked at maintaining the current structure, which it's a pass-through program for the Department of Revenue. We have no performance metrics. We process the forms and we send the payments. But administratively, we're very efficient and it is cost-effective to do it that way. And we did look, the third option that we looked at was consolidating with other programs at housing. And where we landed, our recommendation, if this body decided to continue with the program, is that they consolidate it with the programs at housing. And specifically, housing would like to take this and merge it in with their low-income housing rental fund. As I said before, this one is an age-restricted fund, so the age 62 or older, and the folks that qualify are at or below the 50% of the poverty state poverty level. They have to be rent burdened, which means they pay more than 30% of their rent of their income for rent.
Mr. Chair, do you want to wait until the end to take questions, or
no? Go ahead.
When you say there's a possibility it could merge with a program in housing and community services, has that been discussed between the agencies? Or, it would just move out of revenue shop and into housings without any change in the current character of the program? Or are you talking about changes if it would go to housing?
Chair Girard, Senator Johnson, that we are talking about changes, it would change from the current program and they would merge it with one of their existing programs at housing. And we have talked with them and they are agreeable to do this.
I would just make the comment, Mr. Chair, I think one of the lessons learned from last session was if we change any of these programs that affect the qualifications for participants, that we've got to give sufficient notice so that people are not caught with no other options. And with one of the other senior rental deferral, I mean, not rental, but mortgage, we didn't give any notice when we rather abruptly changed course.
Correct. And that would be important here because where we, as the program currently exists, we send checks out to 2,500 people. Under this program, at the current funding level, it would service about 160 individuals. And that's because, like I said earlier, they're trying to help more individuals that are at risk. And so they will make some rent payments or a utility payment, and they will help with deposits. It also comes with some wraparound services that could include job training, food assistance. It also comes with...
I'm sorry, job training for people 60 and above?
Co-Chair Girard, Senator Johnson, yes, I put that on my notes here, but that might be for one of the program that is not age restricted. It would be more applicable there.
Mr. Chair, can you two agencies merge these programs without legislative approval?
Chair Girard, Senator Johnson, no. Actually, that's why I believe we had the budget note. It was so we could look at it, do some analysis, and we have done that. So if the legislature determines that it should come out of the Department of Revenue, our recommendation would be that it go to housing because they have like programs.
I guess what I'm having a hard time following today is that you're sort of going through the different characters of the program, and is there a staff report that lays out very succinctly the pros and the cons? Because I think that's one of the things that got us into trouble with the mortgage, was this is all the fiscal ramifications, and there was no thoughtful piece that accompanied, that went to all legislators that said, these are the reasons to do it, and this is a very clear summary of the reasons not to do it. And I'm having a pretty tough time following your presentation because maybe I don't know where the story ends. If this is just a fact dump and we're supposed to, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but if this is just sort of give us the facts and we're supposed to kind of intuit what the right answer is, none of us administer this program or know it with the same intimacy that you do. And I think we're really looking, is there a staff recommendation at the end of this trail?
Chair Girard, Senator Johnson, yes, there is. And it's on the report. It's on page 6. And
I'm sorry. I've got the report right in front of me.
Sorry.
I don't know.
Oh,
well, right at the bottom.
So Karen, you, part of your budget note created the workforce, which is supposed to present, I'm assuming right today, the recommendation.
Correct.
As to how we would continue to fund these programs or whether these programs should be terminated. Is that correct?
If I may, yes. Co-Chair Gerd and members of the committee, I don't believe we asked the agency to make a recommendation on whether or not the program should be terminated. I think we asked them to look at possibilities of overlap and opportunities for perhaps moving the program, but I think the idea was for them to bring back information for this subcommittee to see what and make a recommendation that you guys may want to have the agency pursue. In the recommendation that I provided, we've asked the agency to go ahead and, assuming that no one is alarmed by the recommendation, to go ahead and work between now and probably September on trying to figure out how this would be more fleshed out. Your question, how would it really work if you moved it to housing? What are the pieces? A lot in more detail on that along those lines. There is still funding set aside for the second year of the program and a special purpose appropriation the department will need to make payments in November. I don't believe there was an expectation that the program was going to be eliminated during this biennium. If you recall, there was a lot of activity last session to make sure there was funding set aside to support the program in 11-13. I think the future aspect was more about 13-15 and on. What does the legislature want to do with the program? Do they want to continue to fund it? What next steps might there be for?
If I can read the third paragraph of the budget note, it says the work group shall develop a range of service delivery and funding options for the programs. These should include, but are not limited to, complete program elimination, consolidation with other existing programs, or maintenance of the current structure.
And I believe the department indicates they're recommending that this piece would get moved to housing. But the nuts and bolts of that are not fully defined in the report.
And that's the piece, Mr. Chair, that I'm looking for, because your recommendation says integrate it at housing. It's better aligned with their mission, and they can develop some performance measures. What I guess I'm looking for is that piece of analysis that says the age don't line up exactly right. That would, and I'm making this up, that would result in the elimination of X number of people. Or I'm just trying to figure out so the legislature can make an informed decision about what are the consequences of doing any of these. And I think what you're really asking for is we're recommending consolidation. Give us permission now to go forth and flesh that out, and we'll see you at the next set of legislative days to talk about it.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that that's correct. We would be happy to do that.
Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions on page 6 at the top. It talks about why the ERA numbers have steadily declined. It appears to me from the discussion that they've declined because Social Security is indexed to the CPI and the assistance is not. So essentially the people have been starved out of the system. I wonder about the wisdom of that. And then secondly, you go on down to about halfway down on the consolidation with other programs on the same page. And it talks about the low-income housing rental housing fund for each $1 million of ERA and directly invested into the model, 166 households receive assistance. Well, that'd be about $6,000 per household. Is that per year or per biennium?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that is per year.
So that's about $500 a month of these people that aren't that don't have an age issue are getting for their on average for their assistance. So plus they have this other wraparound stuff. I assume that's TANF and SNAP and what else?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it does include those, and I'm not familiar with any other programs that are similar.
Okay. And I guess what I'm getting, where I'm coming to with this is that it seems like those younger people who may be able-bodied are able to access all sorts of things where the older folks are being starved out of their program.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Wissett, the recommendation that we're making, the program that this would go to, is age restricted. It does start at age 62.
Yes, sir.
For the
low-income housing rental housing fund is age restricted at 62?
Yes.
Okay. I apologize. I didn't read that.
Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at page 5, the Department of Revenue has provided a chart in the middle with some statistics reflecting the decrease in number of claims and then projecting out through 2014. And the burden on the state is decreasing from in 2002 of $3.3 million per year down to we're hovering around $1 million per year now. So that decline, it seems like, is based on the income qualification and Social Security payments. This is a program that is still needed and still probably some qualifying folks, but may come to its own end, as you say, starving out. So this is really a policy question, not really a ways and means. And I suspect the only reason why the Department of Revenue is facilitating this is because of your report and payment mechanism and ability to do that. This program itself seems to be kind of phasing out, and the policy issues around it might be better served in a different committee. I say that for whatever that's worth, but that's my take on it.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question about if, and it's general but might apply to, the national bank settlement and where pots of money are going to go. How much discretion are states going to have? How much is that going to be targeted on housing programs? How much is that going to be linked, if at all, specifically to foreclosure programs, foreclosure avoidance, or is this going to go in the general fund? Have you guys come to grips with any of the national settlement stuff?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, that really is outside of our wheelhouse.
Are you sure?
Well, at this point, it is. I don't have any information on that.
Okay.
Who would be the follow-up? So it seems to me there's a few options. Either everything is delineated in the settlement, whereby none of us have to care. All right. That's not my impression. So my impression is that money will be spent somewhere, either more broadly or more narrowly. At the most broadly, it'll be swept and spent on any number of things. At the more narrowly, it'll be spent on housing-specific programs, hopefully the ones that have the greatest leverage to provide, you know, sort of human care and happiness. My hunch is we ought to get an answer to that. And if there were the right person in your shop to bird dog it at least a little bit, that would be valuable.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, we'll take a look at it.
Thanks.
I just can't answer anything today.
I mean, I don't know either.
Okay, thank you.
Can you go ahead and continue, please?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. If there are no more questions on the ERA, I'll just jump in and do a quick summary for the nonprofit housing. This also was created back in the 70s. Its targets, again, rental assistance for elderly, and in this program, elderly is defined at age 62 or older. And in this situation, the property owner, the tenants must meet some federal guidelines. And the assistance comes in here where the nonprofit corporation builds or provides low-income housing. And when they meet the guidelines, they apply to the county. The county gives them a property tax exemption, and that exemption is converted to a rent reduction, and the average rent reduction is $40 a month right now. Where the state comes in is the state reimburses the county, I say counties, local governments, including schools, for that exemption that is given out. if there is no reimbursement, then the exemption still continues because it's in law and those local governments would absorb the exemption. Oversight for DOR, again, it's a pass-through program. We provide the forms. We get the applications. The counties are the ones that actually certify the properties. There's federal and state loan programs out there that monitor the performance of the nonprofit housing corporations to make sure that they're meeting the requirements for and the objectives for the low-income housing. As far as overlap, we found no programs out there that are directly related to the nonprofit housing program. The state law does provide for several property tax exemptions, and those are listed in your report on page 8. The difference there is that they're all just straight property tax exemptions. There's no reimbursement from the state. The options we looked at eliminating the program, and again here, Mr. Chair and committee, we don't have the comparison of the why or how, I guess, of what you were looking for in the ERA. Eliminating the state program, we could do it in a couple ways. You could eliminate the state reimbursement, so keep the exemption, and then the local governments would just absorb it, or you can eliminate the exemption altogether, and that would save about $3 million in a biennium. If you could maintain the current structure, and again, that's a pass-through where DOR has no performance metrics. We just process the claims, and we send the checks. Again, administratively, it's effective, it's efficient, it's low cost. We could do a consolidation, but we found no programs that are similar out there to consolidate with. Our recommendation was a little harder on this one because there are no similar programs. There is a need out there. We can't really speak to the need. There are people in the audience that probably could speak to the need, but this targets a unique audience. It's trying to incentivize nonprofit corporations to provide low-income housing. So it is unique in that way. Currently, the way it's done, the cost is administrative costs, like I said, is low. We're efficient. If we made a recommendation here, it would be to move it to an agency that has programs that are designed to help the elderly and their rental needs. But there wasn't one that deals with the property tax side of it like this one, and so we don't have a recommendation of what agency to go to.
That concludes your comments?
It does.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. In looking at the various options, and I'll go back to eliminate, have you peeled this onion apart to say, you know, you could just eliminate the program tomorrow and that's that, or to phase out so that people that are in the program right now could let it run its course and then just not take new, or did you get down into that depth of detail?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we did not go to that detail. That is something that we would need to flesh out more.
Mrs. Byerly.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. I wanted to share with you, and this kind of tacks onto what Representative Eric Brewer was saying earlier. I did talk to Paul Warner down at Legislative Revenue about this particular item on the list, and we don't currently have a process in place, unlike some of the tax credits, which get reviewed periodically. On the tax exemption side, and on property tax exemptions, there's no process in place to review the exemptions and if they're working and see if they're still, you know, a good fit. In particular, since this is the only one that the State General Fund is reimbursing, it seems like there's a bigger policy issue, too, just about the exemptions in general. Are they accomplishing their goals, not just this one was drawn to the attention of this committee because it was defunded in the governor's budget, which is the driver behind this conversation, which has a lot of policy elements too, but it was the funding component that brought it to the attention of this committee, and that's what created the budget note. So just, you know, I think there's a lot of other issues along that go along with the program besides just the funding piece that probably needs some more review and input from other, potentially other committees in this building.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I draw your attention to page 4. In the 07-09 biennium, $7.5 million was appropriated and 6.2 was spent in 2009-11. 6.4 was appropriated and 5.46 was spent. Did the legislature sweep that money in 2009, or what happened to it? Because $2.3 million not accounted for there.
Senator Witz, members of the subcommittee, I can't remember specifically what happened in 2011 or 2009. If it looked like there were excess dollars in the, it has its own special appropriation. If there were excess monies, it's possible that those could have been disappropriated and put in the general fund, or if they were left at the end of the biennium, they got reverted. I can go back and track that for you, but I don't have the information in front of me.
Would you please?
Yes.
Any further questions from the committee? Remind the committee what we're doing today is simply acknowledging the receipt of the report. However, we can add a letter or comment if we so choose to that. Representative Eric Brewer.
I have one comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this, your recommendation, as you said, was difficult because you didn't identify any additional agency, any other agency that might be having a similar program. It still has to do with housing. But what I'm reading between the lines, providing the policy is still good, and that's something that we can talk about outside of this committee, but providing the policy is still good. The system in place for this program is not broken. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ayer, that is correct.
So, again, if we answer the policy piece, if we continue with it, it's not creating an undue burden or cost to you or the county from what I'm reading in your report.
Correct.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, actually, it's simply a pass-through. We do that all the time, so it really is very easy for us to continue. So the overhead cost is, we do it, it's not a problem. What the problem is that we really don't have information. We simply take the information from the county and do the pass-through to the dollars. So it's more an informational issue, I think, perhaps.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Ms. Barley, again, I believe what you indicated is that we will need a motion and approval of each of the three items, but only one carrier.
And Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, no, these would be treated as separate items before the full committee. However, I just indicated that we can have one work session going for the department, which is fine, but we would want each of these to be handled as separate items.
Okay.
And if I might just, so the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation is that the subcommittee would acknowledge receipt of the report, and I did note in the write-up that there are still dollars sitting in a special purpose appropriation, and that's still in the co-chair plan, but current budget rebalance, for the agency to come forward and request later in the biennium. They would need to make payments in November, and at that time, I think it would be appropriate if there's more pieces related to the program that you want to have them report on, we can have them do some additional work, continue to flesh out recommendations, and provide some of the detail that I think you would, were asking about today.
Okay, the chair would seek a motion to acknowledge the receipt of the report on the elderly rental assistance and nonprofit housing programs.
Mr. Chair, I would move the LFO report to acknowledge the receipt of the reports.
Senator Johnson moves we approve receipt of the report. Any discussion? Senator Johnson.
I just want to be sure that I understand what we're doing. We're receiving the report, and that's fine. The report doesn't give us a clear path to any solution. You need to do more work. And so I don't know at what point we attach that request for additional work on to this activity. Right now we're saying we sat here, we listened to a report, we went, okay, no decisions have been arrived as a result of it. I guess I'm asking Ms. Byerly, where do you give direction or an action item out of the receipt of the report?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I don't believe there's an action item related to the motion. However, I think the department is here to receive direction from you on where you want to go with the recommendations. If you are comfortable with the recommendation regarding moving elderly rental assistance program to housing, I believe the agency would continue to work with housing on how that would actually work, what kind of legislative changes would be required, how the treatment of those people in between the one program at DOR and the program at housing would be accomplished. Again, I think Mr. Ross reported that there is a different number of folks potentially served under that program. The programs don't sound like they're apples to apples. Again, back to some of the comments you made on, you know, senior deferral and have we notified everybody. So I think they would proceed to do that work. On the other program, I guess the way I look at it, it's really part of a bigger discussion around property tax exemptions in general and what the purpose of this particular exemption is and how important it is to the legislature. That may be difficult for the department to respond to, and I just want to acknowledge that from the executive branch perspective, this was a program that was not included in the governor's budget. I don't know if the executive branch or the governor's office has a change of heart as far as how they want to work with the program, you know, in the future either. So, I mean, that's kind of another element out there that's not really addressed in the budget note that I don't think the department can really respond to today either.
Mr. Chair, I guess my problem is I don't have enough facts to make a decision, and I mean, other than to receive the report. But I don't know the magnitude of the work that it would take to flesh this out more thoroughly. Whether or not it divests you guys of the report, whether it turns all of us into advocates for this program. I mean, I'm thinking of people, particularly in the elderly rental assistance program, who are desperately poor people. And we're talking about the magnificent sum of $367 a month annually. To have that amount of money be the difference between being able to stay in a home or not, it seems to me that this is a de minimis amount of money, and we ought to all be fighting like tigers to try to figure out how do you not disadvantage the people that are participatory in this. In the nonprofit corporation, I'm looking and listening to your comment about, well, if we didn't do it, the counties could just suck it up. And I'm thinking about another committee that I sit on. Did I mishear that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, if you thought I said it.
You didn't. You weren't talking.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, what I said was that is an option. I'm not recommending that.
Well, I can tell you for Curry County and some of Klamath, that really isn't an option. So I see this as two very small programs fraught with a bazillion potential unintended consequences, and I just don't know that there's enough data here to say anything. I'm looking for that kind of crisp sheet that says, these are the reasons to do it, these are the reasons not to, this is the amount of money, this is the people or the entities, in the case of the counties, that could come out on a really short end of a stick. Here's what we think you ought to do.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in discussion, in taking one program at a time, the ERA money comes out of the general fund. What would be wrong with allocating that general fund to the low income? There seems like the low income housing, rental housing deal. It seems like they have the same mission. If they had the appropriate infusion of cash to keep those people whole, it would solve the problem and also might give them the opportunity to get the wraparound stuff as well. If there's, you know, these elderly people that Senator Johnson's eloquent was talking about, you know, basically a few dollars makes a difference of in survival or not. the other program doesn't seem to have a problem. I mean, it has a very low overhead. The coming off of the property tax. It's being administered by revenue and being advised by the county. And I mean, if it's not broke, why do we want to fix it?
I'll come back to Mrs. Farley for a moment.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsett, just for clarification, the Nonprofit Home for the Elderly program, the second program, is also receiving general fund. It's getting a direct general fund amount to backfill, basically, the property taxes lost to the counties because of the exemption. Okay. And again, that the reason for the budget note was because that program had been defunded when DOR came forward to budget hearings in 2011, that money was not included in the budget, is what sparked the conversation about both programs, how they work together, who are they serving, and there were lots of questions that the agency didn't have information on because they don't deal with the clients. They're simply operating a pass-through program. As far as the actions of the committee today, I didn't recall that there was going to be an expectation that this committee make a decision today on what should happen with the programs. The way I understood the budget note was that the agency was supposed to bring back information, having talked to those other entities, because during session we didn't have that information. So to provide some information for this committee to think about and for the legislature overall to kind of chew on, expecting that there might be, if there was going to be a programmatic change, it would be something that would be addressed during the 13 session, not during the interim. That probably doesn't help, but I didn't walk away thinking that this budget note meant that this committee was going to make a decision on whether these programs live or die in this month.
So you're suggesting basically that we just simply accept the report. The department, as I think, had a good feedback from this committee today, but I'm not sure whether we should perhaps add some instructions to the department to return to a legislative committee at the next opportunity and describe in detail a little more of what's happening with the programs and the direction they are in and going.
I guess
My
only comment would be, I don't want to send you guys off to just study and study and study and study a $2 million program. This is one of these instances where I don't see a whole lot of choice. The only policy decision would be, do you end it at a time, give notice that the people that are still in it could participate and you don't have any additional people added at the front end. But I don't know how much more study there is to do. I subscribe to Senator Whitsett's theory that on the not-for-profit corporation, there's not much broken there. And so this is really the question of advocacy for an appropriation of general fund for these programs. Mm-hmm. If you only have a dollar, would I give it the dollar to either one of these or to something else? And I can pretty clearly say that this would be pretty high on my list, particularly for the elderly rental assistance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, committee, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last time, when we were trying to figure out this situation, I think we were all struck by the problem that this seemed to have a heavy component of policy choice, effectiveness of program, who is impacted, you know, what persons, what counties, and so forth. And as a Ways and Means Committee, it was distressing to realized that this had not been discussed in a policy committee, whether it was on the housing side or human services. And I know that I felt that it really needed some review by people who are familiar with services to seniors in particular, to know how this then fit in with other services. Because right now we're thinking about this program or these couple of programs only, but there are some other things out there that are programs for seniors, and it still seems difficult to me to think that it's our responsibility
whether it's now or next year, to make a decision when there still hasn't been a policy review or a policy committee discussion.
What complicates all this is the workforce group that was supposed to respond, it was in the budget note, to respond to the legislature about just the same questions we're asking. The department really isn't to the point where they can give us, and really the question then arises, should it be to us? Because it does seem to be more policy. So we have a motion to simply acknowledge receipt of the report. Are there any other discussions? Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a more procedural question, and seeing that Senator Johnson, who made the motions, out of the room, if we wanted to make the motion to accept it, but with a note, can it be amended, or can we just send a note to the that we would like to have some policy work done on these programs?
Barley?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Brewer, I don't know why we can't acknowledge the report, and also ask the department to work with to find an appropriate policy committee in the interim to share this information with. The other thing we can do is, this report was disseminated just to Ways and Means. We could have them, we can make sure this report gets out more broadly to the assembly members. We can do that. And then, like I said, they will very likely need to come back probably in September to deal with the funding component. And at that time, we could have them give us an update on that policy work. My only issue is, as from a Ways and Means perspective, I can't guarantee that there's going to be a policy committee that's going to want to look at this issue in the window between now and September, but we can certainly make an effort to see if that can happen.
So did you answer her question?
I don't know. I got rambled.
Do we have to amend the motion
to make
a recommendation to see policy, or can that just be added?
It can be added. I can include something in the material that goes to subcommittee that there was the discussion on this, and we can follow up on making that happen.
It goes to full Ways and Means?
Full Ways and Means, yeah. It'll go to full.
Committee in agreement with that? Okay.
But you don't have Senator
Patty,
Johnson.
Would you see if the senator could come in? Tell her we're ready to. So the motion before us is simply to acknowledge receipt of the report on the elderly rental assistance and nonprofit housing programs. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll wait a moment. Stand at ease until Senator Johnson returns. These are hard days on chairs. Okay, we'll recess the committee in that we have Senator Devlin replacing Senator Johnson on the vote. The motion is simply to accept the report from Department of Revenue on the elderly rental assistance and nonprofit housing programs. We've had discussion. Is there anyone who disagrees? Seeing none, motion passes.
Thank you.
We need a carrier,
please.
Okay. We need a carrier.
Do you know who's that?
Senator Whitsitt will carry.
Senator Devlin.
Okay, we'll move on to... Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, we're in work session, right? So
yes.
We're fine with that, Senator Johnson. As long as we're not taking action. She can come in and out. We're good.
Okay, so we'll continue. Okay, so we'll move on to item two, which is the report on enforcement revenue. And we have some new members coming as part of the panel.
Mr. Co-Chair, this budget note was on developing a methodology of identifying tax receipts resulting from DOR enforcement activities, our audit and collection. And John Hart from our research department is the lead on this, but he also has some folks in the audience that will perhaps help.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is John Hart. I am an economist in the research section, and I'm here to present the specification that we developed for identifying the revenue that is a direct result of the department's enforcement activities. We worked with many members of our department, several people in my section. We also worked with Legislative Revenue Office and Office of Economic Analysis. We presented our results to them several times and to others. And what we found through our project is that identifying the revenue that's a direct result of the department's enforcement actions is kind of a tricky proposition. Some is pretty easy to identify. Revenue from audits is easy to identify. When we find someone who hasn't filed a return and we ask them to file a return, it's pretty easy to identify the revenue from those actions. But a lot of the revenue that we get falls into a gray area. Arguably, we would get very little revenue if we had no enforcement activities, because it's the enforcement that encourages people to file a correct and timely return. But we have a lot more gray areas. If a taxpayer files in April, for instance, and they're just unable to pay, but they make a payment in June, it's hard to know whether that payment was made because they got a collection call or whether that payment was made just because in June they suddenly had income that they were able to pay their debt with. And so with that caveat, we tried to find some relatively simple rules to identify those transactions that were related to the direct actions of an employee at the Department of Revenue. And so we're looking at the direct actions of auditors or filing enforcement staff, or we're looking at the potential direct actions of revenue agents. And in order to do that, we obviously have to rely on the data that we have available and the classifications of the different types of revenue that we have available. And we did that by looking at, there's actually about 140 million transactions that we looked at for the personal income tax program. And I'm going to focus on personal income tax because it's the largest of the programs. And we were able to first ask, what is the source of the tax liability? Most of the tax liability and most of the receipts that come in to the state through the Department of Revenue are self-assessed. The taxpayer told us that they owed the money, and normally the taxpayer has either paid the money through withholding or made estimated payments or a payment with their return. The second category of the source of liability that we have is enforced filing. We have a unit that looks at taxpayers who should have filed but haven't, looks for taxpayers who should have filed but haven't, and they send them letters, they send them a request to file, and if their efforts go unheeded, we can actually file a return on behalf of the taxpayer. And so there's two categories of return that we get. There are two categories of return that we get as a result of the enforced filings. The first one is after we send that request to file, we get a return and we get revenue as a result of that return. or after we file a return on behalf of a taxpayer, then we go through generally collection actions and get revenue as a result of those collection actions. In this particular category, there's actually times when we take enforcement action that results in negative net revenue because we find somebody who had withholding and we ask them to file a return, and they file a return and they get a refund. And we're actually counting that refund as kind of negative enforcement revenue. The third category from which we can learn of a tax liability is through audits or through adjustments to returns as the return is being processed. And in those cases, we have identified what we believe to be an error or an omission, and we adjust the return, and we create a liability based on that adjustment, and the revenue that comes in is based on that adjustment. So after we know kind of the source of liability, then we have questions about what is the source of the payment. And so kind of within each of those categories of liability, then we ask, did the payment come in for an account that was not in the collection system? Did the payment come in as a result of a refund owing on a different tax program or different tax year? We call those offsets. So if a taxpayer files a 2011 return this year and is owed a refund, but they also at the same time have an outstanding liability for 2010, we'll use that refund from 2011 to offset the liability from 2010. And so that's one of our criteria is, was it made by offset? The offsets are not a result of direct human action unless the liability came from audit or filing enforcement. So if it's a self-assessed return, we chose to call the offset indirect, whereas for the other liability types, we called it direct. The next type of payment is garnishment, and garnishments are set up by our collection agents, our revenue agents, who generally contact a taxpayer's employer or bank and ask to have a portion of the wages or a portion of an asset assigned to the department. And because that takes the direct action of a revenue agent, we've called those direct. And our last question is, if we've gone through all those other types of payments and it's not direct yet, was the account in active collection or was the account on a payment plan at the time the payment came in? And if those are the case, then we call it direct. And I know that's a lot of detail. We developed a matrix, and this is thankfully the simplified version of the matrix to get at these concepts. So the rows along the left side are the types of payments, and the columns from the left to the right are the source of the tax liability. And so depending on which bucket something falls in, we've called it either direct or indirect. And as I said earlier, these are really all kind of shades of gray. We've tried to kind of find those buckets with a tipping point where most of the payments in those buckets were a direct result of the department action. And so looking at the $140 million personal income tax, which we call PIT, for better or worse, looking at the 140 million transactions, we come up with...
Excuse me, did you say PIT?
PIT, yes. So if I slip into it's as the personal income tax, PIT, I think other states might call it, but for better or worse, we call it PIT.
Okay.
The result of applying those rules that we developed to all the transactions that we had since fiscal year 1998 is presented here. And you can see the bottom line in red is the audit source revenue. The middle line in green is the filing enforcement revenue. And the I hope that's blue, on the top is the self-assessed revenue. And you can see the history of how this revenue has come in by year. So That quantitative bit is the quantitative result. We have now a time series of receipts that we can analyze kind of with relation to history. It's worth noting that there's other ways that you might do the specifications. For instance, our filing enforcement specification only counts the first return after we contact a taxpayer and ask them to file. You could argue that the second and third and even continuing returns and payments should be counted as filing enforcement revenue. There's probably dozens or hundreds of alternate specifications. And we will continually be taking a look at this and refining it as we go through. In looking at how this revenue was related to changes in staffing, to changes in the economy, to changes in strategy, and to some extent to changes in taxpayer attitudes, we found that there is a large set of variables that affect this revenue. And we could not find one quantitative model that took all of those into account and explained the revenue in full. And so we believe that kind of each question that might arise as to what would the revenue be in this circumstance or that circumstance kind of needs to have its own model developed.
What's the mood of taxpayers right now? Maybe I shouldn't ask.
Mr. Co-Chair, I've looked at that a couple months ago. There is actually a survey done by the IRS Oversight Board that asks questions about that, and it did appear to be declining recently.
Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Thank you for asking. We have presented you the summary version of our paper. We have a much longer version that is often, as I call it, scintillating. Nobody has agreed with me. About 40 pages that does present several models of how you might use the data that we've developed through the specification to predict outcomes in certain circumstances. We've also, one of my colleagues developed kind of a presentation and training for staff in the department on how to use this model to develop estimates for questions related to, say, policy option packages. And with that, I would gladly take any further questions.
Okay. Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had mentioned, and I'm looking a little bit ahead to what you've done there, but your enforcement of direct revenue collections, whatever we want to call it, is about $140 million. Do we have any sense of your, even with your enforcement, what is revenue that we are not getting, hidden economies, whatever, that we are not getting as a state?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Air Brewer, we did do, I believe it was in 2008 and presented in 2009, a tax gap presentation. And we are forced to rely on the IRS estimate of the tax gap for that. And so we have line by line on a federal tax return, kind of what each line is missing in terms of the gap of what should have been paid for that line and what was actually paid for that line. And so we have that. The IRS spent, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars to come up with that estimate. So we rely on their estimate. It does not allow us to make changes for our own efforts. And we believe our efforts, because we're so heavily reliant on the income tax, we believe our efforts are actually stronger than most states. As a consequence, we believe that the IRS may actually be less likely to make efforts in Oregon. They might be concentrating more in Washington. I hope that was responsive to your question and not.
I'm not sure.
Representative Smith.
I'm going to draw my question.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
This is a very thoughtful analysis, and I appreciate it. Do you have performance metrics for your agents? how many cases they clear in X period of time, how many are accumulated in their portfolio, what the appropriate amount of time to clear a case and bring it to resolution with the agency is. Do you track that stuff?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, we do. We have quite a few performance measures, not only in our budget, but we also have measures within each of the divisions. And so, yes, we do have performance measures for those things.
And are you able to glean out of any of those, any of that data, anything that informs how effective your collection agents are? I mean, I understand the difference between the direct and the indirect and trying to figure out whether or not Agent X was able to effectively be direct or indirect. What I'm just trying to figure out is you must have some superstars that clear cases very, very quickly.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we do. We also have a base amount that collectors need to reach in order to be not on a performance plan, so to speak. What we've discovered over time is that when we actually implement any kind of technology, the rate of each collector increases. So we have that those historical numbers. And, we keep track by collector of the work that's being done. We've also done work with auditors, and we'll be talking about that in the next budget note having to do with agency effectiveness.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Well, I bet you just hate it when take a lot of time to prepare information carefully and come up with some really great charts, and then someone wants a different chart. Well, how can you show it to me on this kind of a graph instead of that kind of a graph? When I'm looking at the PIT direct revenue, I don't know what slide number that was, sorry, but it's a stacked bar chart. I started thinking about this, and in some ways it looks kind of hopeful because you see that the total is growing toward the end there. But then I'm thinking, well, how does that compare to what we should have had? Because sometimes raw numbers don't tell the whole story about are we doing better or are we doing worse. They're just raw numbers. And so what's the context? And I was thinking, well, out of the total that's collected in a biennium, how is that going relative to the number of agents there are? Because we also have asked questions in the past, your department as well as other departments, well, tell us how many line staff there are and how many managers there are. And sometimes managers are also doing some of their direct work, and sometimes they're not. So that makes it more difficult in a way. But I'm thinking, well, given how many people are in certain units of your very large department, are they generally collecting more money with fewer people now, or are we able to do a better job because we've implemented technology or people have better training? I guess part of my unease about the information you've presented us is even though you have some very good specific numbers of dollars, I really can't tell whether we're doing as well as we could have done or compared to some other year or some other variable, are we doing better or worse? Can you help me make sense of that?
Absolutely. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, I actually had a few charts in reserve in case questions like this came up. And one of those is rolled together total full-time equivalents for enforcement staff. So that's auditors, collectors, and filing enforcement staff. That's along the bottom axis. And along the left axis is the dollars collected. And these are quarterly numbers, so it's going to be about a fourth of what you saw on the annual. But you can see there that I've actually highlighted the four most recent quarters for our analysis.
The red dots?
The red dots. And what we have there is for a given level of enforcement full-time equivalent staff, we actually have kind of very high collections. So you can almost think of this as kind of the average enforcement per person if we were to draw that out. And so above the trend line is higher than average, and below the trend line is lower than average. And we're much higher than average. Now, some of that we can assuredly take credit for through our process improvements and certain programs to speed up revenue and get revenue into the 09-11 biennium. Some of that is some of the measurement issues with looking at collections. One thing that happens in a down economy is you have people who pay late because they're not able to pay when they file their return. And so we're just going to measure more collections in a down economy. I might have said too much. Was that responsive?
Yes, that's helpful. Thank you. May I follow up briefly?
Or follow.
So then one of the conclusions is some of that is basically one-time money. As you mentioned, a program to hurry up and get some stuff now and not have it wait. So over time, we wouldn't see that excellent result sustained.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, some of that, some of that hurry up or speed up money would be expected to disappear. We have been pleasantly surprised so far in the current fiscal year that these numbers have not gone down. We don't know if we've reached kind of a new plateau or if we're above trend and we're going to drop back to trend, but we're still above trend.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be moving forward to the next report, but I would really like to have time to discuss, not reorganization, not creating new programs or new administrative roles, but the Department of Revenue, from my perspective, collects and distributes revenue. And in the last biennium, our accounts receivable, state accounts receivable, went up $300 million. And I think we need to, if you were in a private sector business and your accounts receivable went up $300 million, you'd have a problem, severe problem. So I would hope that we could focus on how we're going to, not reorganization and so forth, but how do you go about picking the low-hanging fruit? How do you go about starting to collect this revenue? The $300 million increase is only part of a $1.5 billion or whatever of uncollected revenue, a lot of which is old and isn't collectible. But the new $300 million we ought to be focusing on.
Representative Eric Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I look at that, the prior chart, the PIT direct revenue in millions, it looks like about 50% of it's coming from self-assessment. So when you're talking about enforcement, it looks like the bulk of this, the blue lines, but it looks like the bulk of it is really on collection efforts, not on income that's not reported or not on income that's underreported, but it's truly on the once the liability's been assessed, now we're in the collection process. Is that a fair analysis?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, for the self-assessed liabilities, yes, that's fair. That is somebody who told us what they owed, but they, for whatever reason, were unable to pay.
If I might follow up then. So we've been kind of contemplating changing in collection efforts with the Department of Revenue. Do you have an opinion as to outsourcing, privatizing versus keeping inside for the collection arm of this, not the assessment, not the proper filing, but the actual collection arm of it? Do you have any input from the agency as a result, looking on these results and trending?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, the department did a study that I'm not sure was real scientific that showed that the collection agency wasn't as effective at collecting as the department was. The department has several inherent advantages, and as we replace our systems and have kind of a single view of the taxpayer, we might have even more advantages in being able to see state employment data to see if there's a job where there's a garnishment source and that type of thing. And so it doesn't appear that there's a performance advantage in outsourcing that, but that is probably really my opinion and not the opinion of the department.
It's a good opinion, John.
Thank you.
Any further questions for the panel? Senator Johnson?
I guess the one that I would go back to is the question posed by Senator Whitsitt, and that was, we have all of this outstanding accounts receivable, including the new $300 million. Do you guys have a plan? I mean, other than just turn it over to our collection guys and process it like we always do, is there something more robust given the accumulation of these uncollectible debts?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, first of all, you know, this is a churning account,
right.
So it's not that we don't collect it. It's just that when we do collect it and we find new liabilities, then they go back into the account. So it's not that it's a stagnant account. We are collecting most current debt faster, which will help bring the AR down. There is a lot of old debt sitting in there that is not collectible. We know that. So we're really concentrating on the collectible debt. We're also working with the collection agencies to get them debt that they can actually collect better and faster. So, yes, we do have a plan. But quite frankly, the core system replacement is going to be the best plan for us because it's going to give us tools that we do not have to sort through, to match, to see what is the most collectible. We don't have – the only way we can do that today is manually in terms of determining what accounts are the best to collect now and what accounts we should, you know, we shouldn't be wasting our time on because they're not collectible.
Is that the case that you need new computing horsepower because you either haven't kept these records, they're too voluminous to sort through individual file at a time? I mean, you must have a rough idea of how much of this debt goes back, say, a decade.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we probably do. I don't know for sure. We can take a look at AR and bring you a report on that if you would like.
I guess the one other piece that I'm just forced to ask is, so you get a new computer tomorrow and it's there. The data isn't going to jump into it. Somebody's going to have to dig back through all of these accounts to actually put them into a management system. And has any thought been given at that point in time to how do you sort this? What do you do about collecting it? What's the oldest? And at what point do we develop a mechanism to get some of the stuff that's deemed absolutely uncollectible out of the system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we have a couple of things that need to go on. First of all, when we do put the data into the system, the new core system, we need to make sure that we call it cleansing, making sure that the data that we're putting in is good data. But the system itself does data management. It looks at these accounts. It has the knowledge within it, if you will, to actually take a look at what the account is and rate it. That's what part of the system does. It's a data warehouse that allows this kind of case management, and we simply don't have that today. So there will be better management of AR with the new system, but we're also going to find folks who are not filing today, and the AR, when we do file it, when we do find them, that's going to increase. So initially, you actually may have an AR that's increasing, because we're finding more taxpayers who are not filing.
Thank you.
Okay, committee, we make a quick, if you will, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. My own management instinct, as I've shared with you privately for a year, has some overlap, some meaningful overlap with Senator Whitsitt's, which I fear you're making a wrong management decision. to say, let's invest in technology now so we'll get more voluntary compliance later. If I were you, and I could be wrong, and I don't have all the facts, but if I were, but I feel it pretty strongly. It doesn't mean I don't have all the data. If I were you, I would make sure I was reaching diminishing marginal returns based on current capacity, current technology, until I was reaching diminishing marginal returns on collections. And then and only then would I make capital investments that the making of which diminish my ability to reach that point of diminishing marginal returns. And if I were smart politically, what I would do is I would take some of that maintained graduated curvature and I would say, all right, over this, we're going to capture that money over this and we're going to use that for capital expenditure. And I would come to the committee with that report. But I wouldn't say, well, we don't want to be doing any more collections because right now we don't want to maximize collections because we want to build this system. I think it's backwards.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, I hope that I did not leave the impression that we were not maximizing collections today. We are. We're doing it with the tools that we have.
Okay.
We're at this point. You know, we're full steam ahead. We were full steam ahead last biennium, which is how we got to the red, the four red.
Big blue, big red.
Yeah. So that hasn't changed. We're
we're
doing our usual work as well as getting ready for the system replacement.
Okay, committee.
Okay,
we have to move along. We still have another report yet to go. Can you get that report done in 5 minutes?
Mr. Chair, I can.
Okay. So the chair would, at this point, entertain a motion to acknowledge receipt of the report on enforcement revenue.
I make that motion.
Representative Nathanson has made that motion. Any further discussion? Is there anyone opposed? The motion is passed. And we need a carrier.
Let me do this one.
You want to carry another one?
Senator Whitman.
Okay, yes, please. Okay. Representative Nathanson will carry. Okay, now we'll open up the report on agency effectiveness.
Mr. Co-Chair, I hope I can do it in 5 minutes, so I'll give it a shot.
If you're not, you'll be cut off directly at 4:30.
Okay.
A giant thing comes down on top of
you. On top of me? Okay. It'll
pleasant.
Be ugly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2011, first of all, I'd like to let you know that we have done quite a bit in the last couple of years to improve our agency's business practices and processes. You have a 26-page report that talks to you about all the things that we've done, and I'm just going to highlight a few of them. During 2011, we actually created a program management office. Basically, what this is, it's an agency-wide approach. It provides standards and consistency for all of our projects, and we maximize the time and the money that we spend to deliver all of the desired outcomes. Basically, it gives everyone in the organization predictability. We look at all alternatives before we actually work on a project, and we assure that the right projects are done at the right time, at the right in the right manner. And anything that is across division lines, anything that has stakeholders that cross division lines, go through this process. So it prioritizes critical work because we have very limited resources, and we decide as the program management office what things we are actually going to take on and accomplish. We've also done a number of rapid process improvements. This involves our staff. They do process mapping. They take a look at a process, and they go through and they lean it out. You actually had the auditors come before you during the session in February. One of the things they've discovered is their audit process, they were able to reduce the number of steps in that process by 22% with the work that they're continuing to do. Their estimated turnaround time now for business audits was reduced by 55%. Redundant steps were eliminated. Letters were done in plain English. There were a number of other rapid process events that I won't go into, but they are in your report. There were some property tax items. There was a personal income tax settlement offer, rapid process improvement, where all of the settlement offers are now done within about a 30-day time frame. Before, they were about 75 days. We've also engaged all of our staff in something we call revenue roundtables. We brought all of our staff in from the field offices and so on. We had them all in various days come in and talk with us about their ideas in four strategic areas: compliance, customer experience, workforce effectiveness, and strategic partnerships. They gave us 3,200 ideas. We've sorted through that, and page 8 and 9 in your report show you the process that we used for that. But they were filtered into three categories. One was the larger operating strategic ideas. There were some go-forward ideas that were the easy ones, that were quick wins, and could be completed in 4 weeks, and we've done most of those. And there's a page in your report that shows those. We had 38 of them. Most of them are process improvements or workflow improvements, and they're on page 26. Actually, some of those even show that they're still in process or have been stopped. A more updated list shows that they really are all completed. We have process maps, the as-is process, what our processes look like today in our organization, and what they, so that when we get the new system, we can map that process to our current process and get the gap, so that we'll be able to know what we need to change or not with the new vendor. It allows us to develop operational metrics for overall cycle times, work and wait times, and we collect and analyze that data. And allows us to provide opportunities for operational improvement. We'll find the bottlenecks and streamline them. On page 11, we have a number of surveys that provide us feedback about our processes. These are not internal surveys. These are external surveys with business partners and so on. And I think I'm going to leave. We do have measures. Those are also handled in the report. We currently have 8 measures that define what we are doing in terms of the core system replacement operational metrics, and they're laid out in the decision tree on page 11, I believe, and 13. We have strategies for the tax gap. Those are on page 14. We have an agency strategic plan. The core system replacement, of course, is a focus of that, but we also have the increasing voluntary compliance and revenue, improving customer service, increasing the agency's overall efficiency, and increasing flexibility in overall tax administration. The income tax programs themselves also have a strategic plan that feeds into the agency plan, and their main plan concentrates on maximizing the revenues that are paid voluntarily and growing that population. They also have, there are 3 high-level outcomes, which are identifying non-filers, ensuring taxpayers pay the correct tax, and resolving taxpayer debt. We do have metrics for all of that. Those are in the report on page 14. And tax amnesty has given us a lot of data to analyze. We're in the process of doing that, and that will help us improve education, assistant, and enforcement efforts. We also have fabulous employees, and we're growing that talent. We are able now to train employees remotely rather than bringing them all into Salem. We have video conferencing that we're using, and I'll just leave it at that. And the final topic on this particular budget note was the engagement of the frontline staff. We surveyed all of our staff, and there is a document on page 18 that talks about that survey. We've also had more recent surveys, and I do want to share and be very transparent that our recent surveys haven't been great. We had a change, a survey to see how we were set for change. And within the organization, folks said, you know, there's a lot of change going on. We think we need change. We're not sure we're going to be successful doing this. We know we need core systems, but we're a little concerned about that and about the resources that we have within the organization to pull it off. All of these things that were brought out in the surveys, we've gone back and had face-to-face conversations with all of our staff in the field offices and in the office in Salem. And we're working together to increase communication so that people do feel more comfortable and are able to come along a little bit better with the change. We have a we have revenue town halls. We have videos, director videos that are starting, much more a blog, much more communication so that people are kept on track in terms of what is occurring. So to put it in a nutshell, we have done many, many things within the organization. The staff has been very involved and given us great ideas. We've implemented quite a few of them, and you have many of them in your report, just to give you an idea of some of the energy that's going on at the organization. So I thank you very much for allowing us to present our budget note reports today, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Director Gregory? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you for not letting that fall on me.
Yes, it's still up there and it looks pretty solid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
The chair would entertain a motion to accept or to acknowledge receipt of the report on agency effectiveness.
So moved.
Representative Smith moves. Any discussion? Seeing none, anyone who disagrees? Seeing none, motion is carried, and we are adjourned.